This week, we're joined by none other than Joe Martinez, Masonic lecturer, writer, and one of the founding architects of the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. This week, we discuss a fan and listener requested topic, fallen angels, aliens, and Freemasonry.
Why couldn't it be true, you know, 7 or 10 or 20,000 years ago, if that were the case, that people would see something and ascribe them to some sort of spiritual or deity type of story?
Can we connect it all? What do these ancient rituals teach, and how do they affect us today?
What importance they lie in your life, and how can you can apply them to being a more well-rounded individual in the creation.
Joe and I even broached the topic of one of the Bible's most interesting characters, Enoch, and his relation to Freemasonry. Then we'll have some great news about something we're all very excited about, Wilmshurst University. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 484. Before we get into the awesome interview with Brother Joseph Martinez, a couple things to bring up. I just want to go ahead and thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and our legacy partners, and everybody out there who is assisting us through the sales of any number of things that we do sell in the shop, including the new book, The Master's Word, a short treatise on the Word, the Light, and the Self. I say new, however, this is a reprinted book, all new typeset, all new layout, and is much better than any facsimile reprint you're going to get anywhere else, guaranteed. I was able to put this together with my good friend and brother John Ruark. You all know him from the Masonic Roundtable and various places around the internet. The Master's Word was originally published back in 1913, but it is still so relevant today. I invite you to stop on over at the website wcypodcast.com to see how you can support the show, and if you're interested, check out that new book, The Master's Word, and what people like Jamie Paul Lamb are saying about it. Another book that we recently released was How to Charter a Lodge, a No-Nonsense Unsanctioned Guide. Now, people are asking me, in this time of pandemic, why would you release a book on how to charter a lodge? And let me tell you why. I have been fielding questions forever about how to do this thing called chartering a lodge. How to deal with it, what to expect, all the questions in between. And when I was done with it, you know, we wrote a book during a pandemic. So, wow. Crazy, right? Lots of people did it. What I want to express to you is that this is not time to lean. This is time to clean. You know, in the interim, we're starting to get back in the rhythm of going back to lodges. And now, maybe more than ever, it's really important to start thinking about how you want to get your lodge back on track. And if you can't do that, maybe it's time to start a new one. And this book will tell you how to do that. Presentations that are coming up. I want to give a big shout out to the Valley of Philadelphia, who hosted the virtual Day of Light just recently. We had a great time, great presentations, especially by the brothers there who talked about the Scottish Rite Museum and Library, Jeff Croteau, and some of the others. If that name sounds familiar, that's because he did some of the essay work in the recently released Franken manuscript back in 2017. I was able to do a presentation on the Word, the lost Word, that is. And I think it was well received. I hope it was. The next time I'll be doing a presentation will be It's Business Time. And I'll be talking about the book It's Business Time as well as How to Charter a Lodge. And I'll be doing that alongside my good friend and brother John Ruark, who co-wrote It's Business Time with me. John is a wonderful business partner, and he knows a lot about business and startups and all things in between. So if that interests you, I want you to check out the website and check out the details for It's Business Time. That presentation will be happening on the 4th of March, and it'll be for Bloomington, number 43 here in Illinois. Zoom information will be on the website, and I should mention, because some people forget, this will be Central Time. So if you're Eastern, it's 8. If you're on the Pacific Coast, it's 5. And if you're Mountain, it's 6. After that, what's happening? I don't know. Masonicon, Eddie Ezekiel Bates. They're going to have a limited in-person engagement. I will be there. It will be a lot of fun. I took care of my tickets earlier this week, and I'm really excited to share some fellowship, albeit condensed. Now, speaking of presentations, the guest I had on the show this week, you guys are no stranger to, Brother Joe Martinez, the one of the architects behind Esotericon, as well as several ventures into the realms of Masonic education, particularly the work he has done with the Refracted Light Facebook group, a place where people can go to get amazing types of classes and philosophical discussions and presentations about all things pertinent to Freemasonry and its kindred sciences. The topics on Refracted Light span the gamut. And brother Joe Martinez, in his own right, has presented a number of times on various topics, which he is very learned on. And I'm excited to bring you on into this great fan and listener-requested interview. Let's check it out. All right, everybody, we're lucky enough to have my good friend and brother, Brother Joe Martinez. Many of you know him from Refracted Light, his various presentations there, but also as one of the architects of Esotericon. So please welcome Brother Joe Martinez. Joe, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me as always, Brother Robert.
We've been talking about this for a little while, I think, on and off of channels, and nobody's really directly gone into this because maybe it's a little fringy. However, we've got a number of people who have emailed the program here and asked legitimate questions regarding things like fallen angels, things like ancient aliens, things like mystery schools and Freemasonry and skulls and secret teachings of all ages. And somehow they feel like it's all a big, the ball of lights that Clark Griswold hands his son to, like, figure it out. You know, it's a big, right. So a big tangled ball of wax or ball of lights, whatever. And I guess the best way to start thinking about this, you can say they're one and the same, fallen angels, ancient aliens. It doesn't matter which camp you fall into. I think regardless of which you're into, they both lead to the propagation of knowledge in some sort. That knowledge is then secret, which leads to secret schools of wisdom and then the appropriation of said knowledge into other rites of passage and rites in general, which may or may not have been adopted into Freemasonry in some respect. Looking at things like that, before we just dive in, I want to get your take. What do you think, like, if somebody says, Brother Joe, ancient aliens, fallen angels, Freemasonry, can you put it all together and package it all up like, you know, Indiana Jones, Crystal Skull, or do a better job?
To say that that's a little bit fringy is an understatement. So, yeah, thank you for the loaded question. But, at a surface level, yeah, it all sounds a little bit kooky and it sounds a little bit off to the side. But I think we have to look at the question from several points of view, right? We've got the historical point of view, the pseudo-historical point of view, you know, then we've got the allegorical point of view. So there's different points of view that I think we can look at this subject without A, sounding way too crazy, and number two, trying to see if there's common points of reference along what you posed as a really big topic, right? Like, we went all the way from fallen angels to aliens to skulls. You got to have skulls somewhere in the mix. I'm a fan of that. But I think we really need to look at it at least in those three different points of view to break them apart a little bit more succinctly.
That's fair. Then what we do is let's look at something perhaps from that we're both pretty familiar with. And I guess I should ask, you know, or I should add this to the conversation here, is that the reason I'm talking to Joe Martinez about this is he and I both are fans of history and things like Eleusis and things like ancient aliens and looking at, you know, possible, not that we might not believe in everything that is said on these shows and programs, but we certainly appreciate the points of view and possible correlations, right? Having that thing in common allows us to have this conversation. And I think one element that is probably the thing we should talk about first is the idea of the archetype. Archetypes, right? Similar things in different systems that might have been based on a previous iteration or a previous version or maybe even a idea of the perfect version and then smaller versions coming out of that. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. So, you know, when you talk about archetypes, all of those concepts that you brought up at the beginning, they're very archetypal, right? And the way I look at archetypes is, what is its most pure form, right? Like we can talk about the Adam archetype. You see the Adam archetype in books of scripture and in other legendary tales. And when I use, I think you've heard me say this before, when I use the term myth and I use the term legend, I do not mean them in a derogatory form whatsoever. I use those to talk about really old stories, most of which are oral tradition, that are the stories of a people. So I just want to point that out. Whenever I say myth and legend, I don't mean it in a negative way like we do today. But yeah, the archetypes, a lot of those concepts that you spoke about, angels and aliens, they could be very archetypal when we talk about it from an allegorical point of view, right? To impart a moral lesson on all of us, which is what a lot of these stories do, or to speak about our history or how people remember our history, to talk about a historical event, maybe. I wasn't there, so I don't know. So I can't opine on that. But again, it's how much of what we hear nowadays has been watered down by time and is so far removed from that pure, that alpha archetype, you know?
That's a great explanation. The Adam archetype works very well for, I think, what we're talking about here. Now, when we're looking at things like the ancient alien hypothesis, for people who might not know, you've probably seen the crazy hair guy aliens, you know, meme or whatever on social media. If you want to talk about what ancient alien theory is, it's essentially that, in not so many words, and you know, this is varied also because it's not everything. It's basically one element in relation to angels or fallen angels would be that there were no fallen angels. It was extraterrestrials who came to Earth, perhaps were thrown out of the mothership or exiled from homeworld or something, come to Earth. Or perhaps an extraterrestrial who decided they were going to help mankind, even so, by giving knowledge or something along these lines. And so this is the ancient alien hypothesis in a nutshell that I suppose I would attach to the idea of angels and such. Would you agree, Joe?
Yeah, I think so. Depending on where those stories came from, you know, if we're talking about ancient South America or ancient Babylon or Mesopotamia, things like that, you do get the sense of, you know, it's about 50-50 where it's your angelic type of person or creature, or that, you know, that lesser god type of creature, right? Like, none of the stories really talk about things from a single monotheistic point of view, right? Except for your three Abrahamic faiths for the most part. But a lot of the ones that came before that, they were very, very polytheistic. So to make the assumption that they were talking about large groups of people or things or creatures, it's definitely within the realm of reality to say that they were talking about a multitude of people, and fallen angels, you know, or people getting their butts whooped and falling out of the sky would certainly classify as that. But again, it really, going back to your archetypes, it really depends on what that earliest form of that story was, right? Because if you do watch things like the History Channel, and yes, I love guys like Georgie Tsoukalos and the crazy hair. I wish I had hair like him. It's amazing. But, you know, and I will happily watch that with a bag of popcorn as a mind number. You know, I don't put a lot of stock into what they say, but I'd say about 2 or 3% of it, they probably are on the mark for, and they don't even realize it. All kidding aside, it's a very Arthur C. Clarke kind of thing, you know, where he says that, you know, any advanced technology, you know, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? So, and you've heard that term thrown around. Why couldn't it be true, you know, 7 or 10 or 20,000 years ago, if that were the case, that people would see something and ascribe them to some sort of spiritual or deity type of story, right? And again, going back to that archetype thing, these stories, it's cool that we had them written down 7 or 10,000 years ago in cuneiform and things like that, but there was probably thousands of years before that where those stories were transmitted orally, just like your stories found in things like the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Bible or the Quran. You know, they were transmitted orally for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So something's going to be removed from that prime archetype to fit the people of that story or the people that are being told that story at the time. And that's just the way society grows, you know.
We have the oldest modern anatomical human skeletons being found in Morocco, which date to 300,000 years old. 300,000 years old. I mean, that is insane. So yeah, I totally agree. You know, in relation to the propagation of the story moving forward, you know, mouth to ear, in writing has not been around, that we know in the form that we know it in any capacity close to 300,000 years. What you said about Arthur C. Clarke is interesting, because when we think about it today, we tend to think that, you know, we're humans and we're all knowing, and we would be able to tell if something in front of us was, you know, truly magic or technology. We also, as a species, it's arguable to think about this concept, but as a species, we really don't know how smart we are. Like, we think we're super smart, but we could be really dumb and we don't know.
it's funny. I was talking to my daughter, whom you know, we were having a conversation, or we were watching, I think, the Discovery Channel or something. And we started the conversation up about dinosaurs and humans. And we actually had a conversation about this, where the dinosaurs, for all the times that an asteroid hit them or the climate changed and they died and came back, they were around for 70 million years, 70 million, you know, to get things right and to mess up and start all over again. 70 million years. We've been around for less than two, you know, and when you talk about modern anatomical humans, less than that, you know what I mean? So in the grand scheme of things, we haven't had a lot of time here to tell our story. And I think that it gets convoluted even further by going back to the dinosaur example. You know, they didn't have society, they didn't have culture, they didn't write crap down, whereas we have now begun to transmit that knowledge verbally and by writing it down, by understanding language. So these concepts haven't been around for that long of a time that we can say that we're experts at them in any way, shape, or form. You know what I mean? We don't know what happened with modern humans 150,000 years ago. You know, they might have been just as verbose and talk a lot, and maybe they had memes carved on walls. We just don't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think about the development of the human brain, and I think about how in 10,000 years, the human brain's development, if it stays on track, is continuing to develop at the rate it is, they will be solving problems in the future that we can't even, like, that problem can't even be conceptualized by the current brain. And this is what throws this whole thing for a loop. And that's, if these ancient cultures had experienced something, I mean, it would literally come across as a divine blinding light. Right? Like, you would not know. It would be like the worst acid trip of your life, but you hadn't taken anything. And now you're forced to deal with the situation and come out of it and explain what you saw in a way that only makes sense to you and you're given, you know, time.
Right.
So if we move forward and we think, okay, let's get past the idea of a hidden, or, you know, these fallen angels, or, you know, maybe they're aliens or whatever. There's a knowledge that's transmitted just on a whim. If there was a knowledge transmitted, be it any of the liberal arts and sciences, trivium, quadrivium, aside from those things, maybe like, well, maybe even at that time, those things are considered secret, right? Because they are advanced teachings of the day. But what are the chances that this is the knowledge, and how much stock can we put in to the idea of esoteric knowledge or hidden knowledge or occulted knowledge that's passed from these beings, whatever they might be, and then taking a path through initiatory schools? Like, let's unpack that a little bit. What do you think?
Sure. So there's a lot of parts to that question. So let's start with the beginning of it. Well, we know that a lot of your, and you know, folks who listen to your show know that the terms occult and esoteric are very misconstrued nowadays, because all it means is hidden or only for the select few. But to your point, let's start with, again, facts that we do know. Things like science and religion were very, they were kind of one and the same in your ancient cultures, right? There wasn't really a segregation between a scientist and a priest, right? Look at astronomy. You know, astronomy and astrology were not two separate sciences thousands of years ago. They were one. And to that point, you have people who, the keepers of that knowledge, whether you want to call it science or religion or a combination of the two, those were normally your priesthood type of people, right? Whether it was Egypt or schools of thought before that, it was your priestly line. And that kind of translated out into, you know, a lot of other cultures that we're more familiar with. But they had the lock and key on who could receive that knowledge And it was definitely for the chosen few, not for the masses. And we can talk about parables all day long that talk about that in other cultures and societies and faith groups. But back to your question. So if we know for a fact that your select few had this quote unquote secret knowledge and only transmitted it within their own circle, then there has to be a path for that, regardless of what school of thought you lived in. And I think that's where initiation comes into play. Because whether it's the, you know, things as simple as the seven liberal arts and sciences, or maybe it's something else, or maybe that's just a roadmap to teach you how to learn more about things like your creator or the creation itself, and how to be more at one with it. You need a place to start, and you need something that's going to test you to make sure that you're quote unquote, it sounds kind of weird, worthy enough to receive it. And we've lost a lot of that in our modern day and age. You know, initiation held a lot more importance to people, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years ago than it does today. For the most part, modern society kind of scoffs at it, but, you know, look at what we've lost as a result. So I think I touched on every single bit of your question, but maybe not.
So you mentioned this idea of keepers of knowledge, and the first place my mind goes is the beginning of Asimov's Foundation series. There is a planet that's basically ruled by a priesthood. The priesthood knows the secrets of the energy production, and that it's a technology game, and they don't want the people to know because they're a tribal and less experienced people, so it's how they control that mass. And I just thought that was interesting. You know, if the listener at home, you know, pulls some thread or that gives you some visualization or clarity on something, awesome. If not, I digress. Look, my next question for you, Joe, is what about this knowledge that's secret? Why is it secret? To help with that, let me ask this question as an addendum. In modern society, the Masonic fraternity gets a lot of criticism in the form of, you know, blog posts or anti-Masonry. And it comes at this thing like, well, why do you have secrets? Why do you have secrets? Now, one, before you answer that, I want to say that the secrets we're talking about are not handshakes, modes of recognition, points of entrance, lectures, that kind of thing. The secrets that I'm talking about are like almost revelation type things that happen to the individual, and that maybe you can talk to a brother about, maybe you can't. But the question is, why is the knowledge secret? Why don't Freemasons just go, here's the big thing, and throw it out there for the world to examine and to take? Why don't we do that?
Not to pick on just Freemasons, right? But to go back to what you said earlier, a lot of your, what we call mystery schools, subscribe to this idea that, you know, through the path of initiation comes certain pieces of knowledge or information that will, let's use the bumper sticker comment and make you a better person, right? Hate those bumper stickers. But to your point, is there, going back to the beginning of your question, is there secret knowledge? Yes and no. You know, is geometry really secret? No, you learn it in 10th grade. Were you paying attention? No, probably not. You know, how many people use geometry on a day-to-day basis, you know, unless you're an engineer or an architect or something? But then are you actually taking what you learned about geometry or astronomy or music and looking at life a little bit differently? That's the difference between learning those subjects and speaking about them on a path towards initiation. And that's the difference, right? Initiation is the path towards leading you to a destination, your own destination, not anybody else's destination. So me and Robert's destinations are two completely different places. But we've been given a path to walk down that will lead us probably in the same direction, hopefully. Otherwise, what's the point? Is there secret knowledge? Again, yes and no. It's, you could take the seven liberal arts and sciences and learn about them and read a book on them. Great. I mean, you've not mastered anything about yourself. It's the path you take on that journey to learn them and what importance they lie in your life and how can you can apply them to being a more well-rounded individual in the creation, for lack of a better term. That's what's different. So yeah, I mean, I think that initiation plays a really important part on making that knowledge secret. And it's not something, and I think you've said this before plenty of times, it's not something you can put in a book and put a Grand Lodge sticker on it and sell it to people. You know, here's the secret of Freemasonry. It doesn't work like that. It's, you need to walk down that path yourself, and learn it for yourself. And then, as you know, the majority of the people don't, you know, they just show up and have the minutes read and make fun of each other, you know, and say dumb stuff from the sidelines and, you know, don't really get much out of it. But for those few that are there to actually make this a part of their inner being, they get it, you know, and those are the ones that we should keep and try to keep interested and motivate.
That's a fair answer. I think you touched on a lot of elements in there that probably the most true thing that I found that you said, aside from the fact that it's an experiential based knowledge that can be gained. So maybe for the answer then, you know, why is this stuff secret? Why do Freemasons, why do these occult organizations keep it from people? And the answer isn't so much that we keep it from you. It's that you keep it from yourself because you're not walking the path, right? You said something that was interesting also in that you said, for lack of a better term, but it probably is the best term, is your place in the creation. Can you talk a little bit about that view?
Yeah, and I'm trying to be as liberal as I can with my answer, right? Because I don't want it to sound slanted one way or the other. But for me, I could talk about my own experience. Learning that quote-unquote secret knowledge, which is not secret, you can find it on the internet, and learning how to apply it in your own life, for me, it teaches me, let's start at the beginning, how to absorb knowledge and how to take that knowledge and make logical decisions, and then how to have an intelligent conversation about it, right? So now we've knocked out the trivium. So now onto the quadrivium, how to speak the language of the universe. That's arithmetic right there. Everything you want to know about the universe is in math. And then geometry, you know, the how the inner workings of those numbers make the universe move. And then from there, we go into music or vibration. What's that underlying song in the creation or the universe? And I use those terms interchangeably. And then finally, you know, astronomy. All of these things show us how to read that language or that story in the creation narrative, or how to want to seek more information about it. And I think the more that we know and the more that we care, it makes us a much more worthwhile participant in that creation story, you know, as opposed to just a passenger. You know, we're actively seeking and learning, and that's what separates us from those dinosaurs that lived for 70 million years. You know, it's that desire to seek and know and want to be a part of something greater than ourselves.
What's interesting about what you just mentioned was the idea of evolving eyes and evolving consciousness through your own personal studies in what I would call quantifiable sciences. What I mean by that is we have categorized and quantified intellectual concepts in both language understanding and scientific pursuit. And the scientific pursuit, of course, like, we don't invent mathematics, we discover mathematics. Once we have mastered, quote unquote, the languages that we're talking about in the trivium and quadrivium, it's almost as if our revelations books. So if you're a practitioner of a revealed religion, like you talked about earlier, that any book, any religion that has a holy book, then is it fair to say each person understands that book from the vantage point wherever they are in their life at that time, right? So then as you evolve in conscious mind, the book might mean something totally different to you the next time you look at it. One thing I want to go back to the idea of the fallen angel, ancient aliens, dissemination of secret knowledge, if you will. There seems to be also this idea that perhaps by taking away the ineffable nature of things, you start to place yourself in a camp that within at least Freemasonry is the red zone, which is almost atheism. So if you say something like, we don't want to say angels didn't exist because if they're aliens, then that somehow takes away from the argument for a creator. What are your thoughts there?
I want to preface this with, these are my own thoughts on my faith. I'll say my faith, not just faith in general. These are my personal thoughts. You made a great comment before about how you can look at different faith systems differently over places in time. If you had asked me these questions when I was 20, I'd look at you like you were insane. Like, no, what the hell are you talking about? This is this and that is that. And shut up, Robert. But you're absolutely right. The more you, not just the more you know, but the more you want to know, your outlook changes on things. So that being said, It really depends on the faith system that you practice and what you're being told are your guardrails, right? Because every faith system has guardrails. You know, angels, let's look at angels, for example. Depending on if you are a practitioner in a Jewish faith or in a Christian faith and the wide multitude of those, or even something in the Islamic faith, angels take on a different form and have a different meaning and are represented differently in each of these narratives, right? And we're just talking about the Abrahamic faith. And like, we're not even going to talk about stuff that came before that or in different parts of the world. In some faith systems, they're looked at as aspects of that creator, right? In some, they are that in between, going back to the Nephilim. They're that in between divine and man, especially when they come down and have babies with our women. Or they are, you know, messenger folk that come down to perform a particular task and then they go away. Or you can look at it like something in the Old Testament where it has like 8,000 eyes and fire shooting out of every which orifice and stuff. So it runs the gamut on how they're represented and what they actually mean. So that's why I say it really depends on the guardrails or what's told to you in your faith system as what an angel is for you to be able to define what a fallen angel is. But back to your point about when we start to unpack that a little bit, I mean, that's just obtuse, you know, and people who make comments like that are really just close-minded and obtuse. And I'm not saying you have to change how someone thinks or how they believe or have to change their faith, but to just regurgitate something back to me and that's the only basis you have to speak on it, that's really, my 7-year-old can do that. You know, I don't expect that from a grown person. I mean, other than to say it's an obtuse way of thinking. You wouldn't expect to find close-minded folks like that in a system that we just talked about, but I guess you do.
Yeah, we do. We do find that. It is very frustrating. You know, I tell the story all the time, you know, in the simplest, most profane way. It was when I was 7 or 8 years old asking my dad why strawberries have seeds on the outside. And he said, you know, took a drink of his beer, looked at me, and he said, "That's a good question, son." And then he took a drink of his beer and turned and started talking to his buddy again. And, I don't appreciate those kind of answers, from anybody, let alone, you know, our spiritual leaders. I grew up Roman Catholic and, went to church in Naples, Italy, where my dad was stationed. And, we went to an Italian church and the pastor there was an English speaker also. So, man, like, I would ask him all kinds of stuff. And he never once disappointed with a great answer. And that's the kind of, I think, thinking that's really needed, and being open-minded and being able to connect to the person asking the question in a way that validates their thinking, but also offers them a tie-in to the practice of the faith. One of the ideas that, as you were talking, admittedly, my brain started spinning about some of the concepts the late, great McNulty. One of his books, The Way of the Craftsman, I believe it is, you know, talks about elements of the Masonic ritual as archetypes for consciousness, to tell a story, the story that plays out in our third degree in the second section, everybody knows. McNulty proposes that this is an action. This can be the archetypally explained through elements of your own consciousness. In that similar vein, when we look back at, let's say, ancient texts, ancient accounts, I want to say to everybody listening also that one of the reasons why I think Joe is an excellent guest to have on the show is that he is currently in the study of these types of things. He's taking Greek language and is immersed in this, and I get to see his posts on social media about how much he hates his life right now. What I want to ask is, looking through the lens of these ancient peoples, right? Like, you have a better foundation than most when we know, like, I can read a passage from something in Greek in a direct anglicized translation and I go, "Oh, cool, it means this." And then you read it and you go, those words don't really mean that, even though they read as that. They mean something else because context is different. So keeping that in mind, is it possible that things like a fallen angel and the dissemination of knowledge could be an archetype for something else as you look at it through ancient texts?
So yeah, and you're absolutely right, and that's actually a double-edged sword. And so yeah, I am actually a grad student taking biblical studies, not because I want to go start a church or things like that, but because I actually wanted to know more about the ancient writings of the major faith systems. So that's my primary reason for doing it. So promise, I'm not going to proselytize to any of you. That being said, it's actually what I'm learning is it's a double-edged sword, right? Because you have fallacy in modern interpretations of ancient scriptures or ancient writings or ancient documents, but you can go too far one way or the other. Exactly to your point, you know, if you take something that was first written in Hellenized Greek and then Koine Greek and then Latin and then, you know, some weird Middle English language and then back to Latin and then to modern English, yeah, the translations are going to get messed up along the way. You're going to lose a lot of meaning. But there's also, going all the way back to that original writing, there is some of the, and I don't care what book it is, I don't care what faith system you belong to, whoever put that down on paper, they imparted something of their of themselves into it, right? So it's not a completely objective writing style, you know, regardless of what it is. You know, whether it's a census of how many people, you know, died in this thing or how many kings there were in this list or a list of things that you'll find in like the Old Testament, for example. There is subjective opinion based on, it might not be that person's opinion saying, oh, I'm going to make this look cooler because, you know, I'm writing the story. It could be that. But it also, you have a lot of cultural absorption of the people in the time, you know. So going back to, let's go back to, what's a good one? The flood myth. Let's take the flood myth, for example. There are examples of worldwide or localized flood myths that occur in different parts of the world. And they're so numerous that, you know, they probably have to have some sort of common origin or common origins, but it's how that story is told and what those people put based on their own cultural knowledge and the society that they live in that starts to separate them a little bit. So it's a double-edged sword. You can apply modern interpretations to ancient languages and be completely wrong, to your point. And I'm really learning that in a very hard way. But you can also go the other way and say that you have people that were putting in their own subjectivity into those ancient writings and you're trying to get the objective bits out of it. And it's really complicated and hard to do because these people are all dead. So, you know, there's got to be a middle ground there. But I mean, in terms of fallacy, when it comes to ancient documents, I mean, just go on YouTube and Google it for 5 minutes. You'll just see tons of examples of fallacy in the interpretation of things like scriptures based on faith groups and stuff like that. Or it's, you know, look at, I don't want to be so focused on religion because that's not what we're talking about, but let's go back to the flood and science and, you know, modern science and whatever that other kind of science is, where people will pick and choose what they want to support their theory. You know what I mean? But people do that with interpretation of ancient writings as well. You know, they pick something that they really like and they run with it. And that's built entire faith systems around that. You know, I mean, look at how many types of, me being one, I could say it, but look how many different flavors of Christianity they are, and they all have their own little niches and differences, you know?
One of the things that I think is interesting is the application of fallacy to a translation. And when we do this, the best I can hope for, I use the example all the time of Robert Alter's work, because I think that he has the text, you know, he displays the text in a way that is read contextually correct and, you know, grammatically correct in the language that it was originally written, directly translated into English.
Yep.
But his footnotes or his annotations are intellectually honest in that he says it could mean this or it could mean this. And the jury's still out on this. And Bart D. Ehrman does the same thing in biblical studies as well. I highly recommend those guys. We have done this kind of, as you said, this isn't about religion, but it's unavoidable. So with exegesis on any philosophical or religious text, mostly within, I would say, the Western world, it's been focused on Christianity because of the sheer number of people within it. And of course, people like Martin Luther during the Reformation and things really attached learning to the faith. And so when I see certain translations of other holy books being done, sometimes I question just their validity. And this is kind of an aside, but for instance, if I pick up a translation of the Bhagavad Gita which is done perhaps by somebody of a scholarly work and a background in the Hindu faith, it's probably going to be significantly better conveyed to the reader than, say, another really popular translation of the Bhagavad Gita by, like, Annie Besant, let's say, who was a part of Theosophy. I'm sure her translation is great. I own one of them, but I don't know that it's the same. You know, when you say, do you find that with a translation, you get the same problem as the original writers, that they're imparting some version of themselves, even in a translation?
Absolutely. I mean, let's, and again, we're not talking about religion. We're talking about history, right? But let's look at the perfect example, the Septuagint, right? That is the prime example of, I don't want to say mistranslation, but you're definitely putting subjective aspects of it going from Hebrew into Hellenized Greek, right? Because there's a lot of concepts, and Robert Alter actually talks about this in his The Five Books of Moses, a fantastic book. And you're right, I love the footnotes myself. But he really touches on the fact that there's some concepts that showed up around the time of before Koine Greek that did not exist in the Hebrew writing at the time, you know, concepts of like spatial time and things like that and things happening in the future. So these 70 dudes, and that's why they called the Septuagint, had to make some assumptions with, or maybe what they were taught when it came to, you know, those ancient writings about what to translate into Greek to then proffer forward. But Alter makes great cases for why, you know, this has been lost or this has been mistranslated or why we assume this is this, things like that. You know, the all the different meanings of the word love or the different words that mean love in Greek is a great example.
I have two questions. The first is, just for posterity's sake, I want everybody to know that Joe Martinez says that Septuagint means seven dudes. That's a direct translation.
70 dudes. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So you used a term two times that our audience may be unfamiliar with. Can you tell me what Koine Greek is?
Yeah. So Koine Greek is a type of Greek that was, I guess you could call it Hellenistic or Alexandrian Greek. It was the Greek written language that the books of the Christian New Testament were written in. You had ancient Greek, and then you had Attic Greek. And by the time of the writings of, you know, post the birth of the Christian era, you know, around the time of Paul and the people who wrote books of the New Testament, most of that writing was done in Koine Greek. So it's a little bit different, and it's actually a lot less flowery than some of your more ancient types of Greek, like your Hellenic Greek and your Attic or your Ionic Greek. So it's just a different form of the language. And that's what I'm learning now is Koine Greek, because that's what all the books, New Testament books and the like, are all written in their original language. But what stinks is I can't go to Greece and actually speak this stuff because I'll sound like an idiot. So, because nobody speaks in Koine Greek. So, and what was the other term?
I was going to ask you, like, what are the other types of Greek, but you kind of defined that. So with something like Koine Greek, where you say that it's less flowery than its predecessor, question on language, I guess, would be, is it less flowery because they have more precise terms for things as things move forward in time?
No, and I mean, just from what I've learned, it was the Koine Greek was the, again, they call it Alexandrian or Hellenized because it was people like Alexander the Great who added so much landmass to the Greek nation that it became the common tongue for people, whether you lived in Egypt or you lived in Palestine or you lived in Greece. It was the, you know, basically like our English. It was the common tongue. So they wrote these books in the common tongue, so it had the wider range of access to people. So I'd say that's probably why it was less flowery than things like your Attic or your Hellenic Greek. But that's my opinion again.
So, Joe, I want to go back to the beginning when we talked a little bit about some of the concepts of fallen angels or things like of that nature. And one of the things that has always caught my eye when I'm reading or watching a show, you know, I think I got my kick on this way back when I was just 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, probably watching Leonard Nimoy in Search Of while I played hooky from school and pretending to be sick just so I could hang out all day and, eat in my bed and watch Leonard Nimoy. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has always intrigued me, you know, aside from my things like Ezekiel's wheels, which now under a Masonic lens, I mean, I just don't buy the Ezekiel's wheels anymore. I just feel like that's just an ideal of the tetramorph, but right.
Yeah.
It's like, hey guys, why don't you come and listen to this lecture and talk about the tetramorph? Okay. So anyway, Enoch is another one of these concepts. He has these seven watchers. They take Enoch up, and Enoch goes and walks with God and never came back. He's taught maybe the liberal arts and sciences. Is that what the seven watchers were teaching? Who knows? And he gives the knowledge to the people. What are your thoughts about Enoch?
That goes all the way back to the beginning when we started talking about the Nephilim, right? What people probably don't realize is that there's a lot of mistranslations, going back to your points, when it comes to the Nephilim. They normally don't show up in your modern translations of scripture. And in most cases, they're translated as giants. But in some translations, they're translated as fallen ones. So it actually doesn't say fallen angel. So fallen angel, the term fallen angel actually does not exist in any version of the Holy Bible, nor in any of the original Abrahamic scriptures. It was something like, for those of you that are familiar with Jewish tradition, you've got the book of the law, but then you've got the oral traditions that surround it. So the concept of fallen angels kind of sprouted from there, but you can't open up a translation of the Bible and find the term fallen angel, right? So Nephilim has kind of been this weird amorphous term. But back to your point with Enoch, that's considered apocryphal. You know, the books of Enoch are considered apocryphal by many faith systems. If you go to the Ethiopian Christian churches, that is part of their canon. No bones about it. It is part of their Bible system. But in those books, you find the story of Enoch, and exactly to your point, where you have him receiving some sort of divine knowledge. And to your point, it could be something like the seven liberal arts and sciences, but maybe it's how to apply those to have a better understanding of our creator or the creation, you know, whichever road you go down. And to bring that back to something that people like Freemasons are familiar with, you know, in that book itself, it talks about pillars where these secrets are inscribed to protect them from fire and a flood or inundation and conflagration. So that concept is very heavy in those books, which again, most people or most faith systems consider apocryphal, with the exception of, to my knowledge, I think the Ethiopian churches. But again, it's interesting how those archetypes, and Enoch is full of archetypes and really awesome archetypes. So if you've not read 1 and 2 Enoch, just go buy it. Spend the $10, go to Amazon, buy it right now. Because in it, you're going to read these books and you're going to notice that outside of the Ethiopian churches, these books really did not exist until the 20th century. They were lost for a very long time, but yet we have vestiges of them in things like Masonic ritual and schools that existed before that. So I just find that kind of interesting.
It is really interesting, especially considering of all of the biblical characters, Enoch is probably the one that stands out as most interesting and most connected to Freemasonry, only because, okay, Hiram, sure. Okay, King Solomon, sure. Lots of stuff with Solomon. So aside from Solomon, what connects into Freemasonry? And it really is Enoch, because what you learn in later degree systems like the Cryptic Council or the Royal Arch, there is a heavy, heavy influence on the Enochian story. This is where the Scottish Rite, 13th, 14th degree, I think it is also a southern jurisdiction. This is the crypt. It's Enoch's vault. Enoch falls asleep at a hill west of Mount Moriah, where he is given the word by God, his name. And then he's supposed to take this name and he inscribes it on a tablet and he places it on the foundation stone under 9 arches within the earth. So with Enoch, this whole thing comes full circle, and he is represented at least in idea or archetypal idea or by a thread through all of the degrees. And this is just fascinating to me because I hadn't really thought about it until we touched on this topic.
And it's interesting too how little press he gets in something like the Bible, right? He gets very little mention, but yet there's so much more to that story that you find in other texts. And again, taking post-Babylonian exile Jews all the way to the time of the start of the Christian church. You have these stories that existed, and we know for a fact they existed before. We found remnants of them in Aramaic and Koine Greek. But then the story drops off for, 1,700 years? And then picks back up again. But again, we have remnants of it going back to things like Masonic ritual. It's really hard to connect the dots there without there possibly being, and this is where I get a little fringy, possibly there being another underground stream of knowledge that we may not be privy to, you know?
I do know. I know the knowledge. I wish I knew.
Oh.
But I'm with you the whole way. And I think what's interesting is that we have this kind of fascination about this hidden stream of knowledge that countless people have made a buck off of people, if only to wish that they were this adept person in giving out this knowledge. And we think back to the different systems that perhaps influenced Freemasonry through, you know, straight ripping off, appropriation, or, you know, they say imitation is the best form of flattery. In Freemasonry, if it's this kind of all-encompassing stew of different initiatory rites, maybe we have the best of everything, and along comes, you know, with that, maybe some of the worst parts of those systems also. But it feeds this fire, I think, in most Freemasons that we're searching for what's lost and what is that thing, and does it tie back to ancient rites like Eleusis or like any number of the Grecian schools that came before it, or truths, you know, conveyed in Mithraic temples or things of that nature. Before we wrap for the evening, I wanted to ask you your take. Is Freemasonry an amalgamation of different things? Do you think it retains anything from perhaps what it was originally modeled after? Was it modeled after something? Or do you think it was just thrown together out of, you know, discoveries of en vogue biblical texts?
I'm definitely a firm believer that, and I'm probably one of the few that think that Freemasonry, you know, the modern system of the craft degrees of Freemasonry, are a spiritual successor to a lot of the ancient mystery schools. Is there a direct correlation? Maybe, but finding evidence for it is pretty slim. So they definitely are a spiritual successor. Did they take parts of older initiation schools that imparted certain lessons? Absolutely. You know, whether it's the Greek mystery schools or the Mithraic or the Egyptian mystery schools, going back further. I mean, there was a reason why all the really popular dudes in Greece went to Egypt, you know, to go through their mystery schools. It wasn't just for funsies and for a vacation. They made the trek and they spent years there learning from the priesthood in Egypt about certain quote unquote mysteries. Then they brought that stuff back to ancient Greece, you know, before they became a nation state. And a lot of the schools started to pop up there, whether it's the Eleusinian school or the Orphic school. They all imparted a lesson about something in you has to die before you can learn new stuff or be open to learning new stuff, right? And that's basically what actual initiation should be. Now, whether we're doing that right nowadays, I can say I've been to certain places where they do it really well, where they retain the mystery and they retain the solemnity of initiation. I've been to other places where, you know, you knock all this crap out in 3 hours and you go have a crappy lunch too. It kind of runs the gamut. But at our barest level, I do think we are the inheritor to the way to learn about the mysteries. Do we do it well 100% of the time? No. But I mean, we're just a slice of society in general. You know, we're no better than the rest of the society that we make up a part of. So it has your good apples and your bad apples and everything in between. So,
fantastic, Joe. That's the final word. I think you said it best. I want to thank you for finding some time and carving it out of your schedule. I know you are one of the most busy people I know, both in the profane world, with all the work you do, as well as in the fraternity, things like going to lodges and being a part actively in youth groups, and also being a part of you know, online philosophical forums and like Refracted Light, and putting together videos and managing channels, and you're doing so much. And I want to thank you for all that work, because you really are one of the few people out there that are continuing to put forth content that can be absorbed by not only Masons but the profane world alone. And you know, succumbing to a lot of the stigma about crossing the Masonic aisles, if you were, you know, and running a group that is open to anybody who is interested in enlightening their mind to new concepts. So a big hats off to you, and thank you very much for all that you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me. I mean, it's basically all your fault. So, you know, years ago, once I started listening to your podcast, I can owe all of this to you. So thank you for making me a very busy person. It's always an honor to be here. I love your show. I love being on your show. So thank you for having me again, brother.
So Joe, one last question before you go. And this is on everybody's mind. When and is Esotericon 2021 happening?
It is happening. As any of you who like our Facebook page know, we have decided to go all virtual again this year, just like we did last year. So bigger and better. We're going to start announcing speakers probably right around the time this airs. So it's June 12th, I believe, of this year. It is all virtual, and tickets are going to go on sale right after we finish announcing all the speakers. But we're super jazzed, and we learned from all our boo-boos last year doing this virtually for the first time, so it should be a fantastic event.
Super excited about it. You know, I'm going to be pumping it out to everybody else and sharing it everywhere. Really excited for the event. You guys did an amazing job last year. It's going to be great. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, brother.
Well, that was an intense interview, and I hope that the fans and listeners who requested this episode enjoyed, learned something, and I hope we addressed what you were hoping to address. You know, I can't go full blast into these realms of other kind of studies because this is, of course, a podcast about Freemasonry, and sometimes we do venture off talking about some other things, so we felt it was appropriate to make sure that we tied all of these things into Freemasonry. And at times, you know, it is difficult to have these conversations because sometimes they don't really align to certain elements of the craft that other people might think do align to. And nonetheless, I hope you enjoyed. And Brother Joe Martinez, I have to thank you for being such a great sport. If you want to find Joe on social media, you can do so. You'll find him in the Refracted Light Facebook group. Notably, he is one of the gatekeepers of the Refracted Light Facebook group, so find him there. And before we leave you this week, I did want to go ahead and mention something crazy amazing. I ran across some threads on Reddit recently, which I found kind of a bummer, and I get it. I totally get it. I mean, these brothers have valid concerns, and maybe that's just because nobody's ever really come through in such a big way. But a few months ago, I think it was, we talked about this idea of Wilmshurst University. What could that be? Well, Wilmshurst University was a mock website that I put up really just to kind of see what the interest would even be if there were such a thing as a Freemasons, quote-unquote, college. And who would we name it after? Well, I picked Wilmshurst because I love his writings. But more than that, what would it be? Would it be real live classes? Would they just be, you know, your typical Masonic stuff where it's out there, you know, you sign in, you read some books they tell you to read, and then you write some essays, and maybe somebody takes a look at them? Sure, maybe. But what could be more? What could be really fantastic? And the idea came that perhaps Wilmshurst University could be a place where you go, you sign up for classes, and you see a real live class, 6 weeks, 1 hour classes each week, live, with your instructors. The instructors would be certified educators, and in some places they might be experts in their relative fields. What kind of classes would you take? Well, Masonic origins, or a history of the rituals and rites. Maybe the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Now, classes like Masonic Origins, who would teach that? Well, we would find somebody to teach that, perhaps an expert, a world-renowned expert in Masonic Origins, somebody that most Freemasons look to as a voice of authority in this area. A history of rituals and rites. Well, maybe there's a Scottish Rite brother out there who wants to talk or teaches it already. He is a certified teacher. Maybe he can put a class together on the Scottish Rite rituals and rites. Or perhaps we get a certified collegiate professor to talk about the Renaissance and Enlightenment over the course of 6 weeks And you get all of this kind of information coming straight from real educators with real quizzes, real essays, real assignments. So this is more school than it is quote-unquote masterclass. Now, moving forward, what other kind of things could you have? Well, you could have philosophical coursework. You could have practical coursework like mindfulness, contemplating ritual, classes on effective journaling, classes on logic or rhetoric, classes on concepts and history of astrology or music taught by a certified musicologist, and even deeper, elective coursework and master classes like astrology or how to conduct research or practical tarot or physics and spiritualism. And some of these classes can be taught by some of your most influential people in the craft today. So we started off asking the question, what if? Well, guess what? Brother Ben Williams and I have already invested in the LMS structure, a built from the ground up program. We've already got teachers who we're vetting right now and interviewing on a weekly basis who will be putting together their syllabus and coursework that we'll be posting on the website soon. Wilmshurst University is no longer just a dream. It's coming. Live 6-week courses, real instruction, professional teachers and instructors. If you go to the website today, you're going to see a welcome message that says, Wilmshurst University, what was an imaginary concept is now real. Wilmshurst University teaches a curriculum consisting of the great philosophy of the ages, a deeper understanding of ritual, and the holistic values related to leadership. Our coursework is designed to build a foundational of accurate historical knowledge, explore the philosophies, and learn practical application. In addition, we will offer courses in Freemasonry's kindred science taught by leaders in their respective fields. With your help, we have raised enough to begin. In the coming weeks, we're building a unique LMS system for online coursework with live instruction. Our tentative go-live date is the solstice, June 21st. Want to know more? Join the mailing list on the website, and you'll be among the first people to know when courses are announced. Will you answer the call? As cheesy as that might be, I hope that sticks in your head when thinking about gaining more knowledge on the topics within Freemasonry and, again, its kindred sciences that you might have an interest in. You'll see a full gamut of different types of courses on the website. None of them are guaranteed yet. I will tell you, however, we have 4 instructors that will be going live with classes in the first semester. Classes will be limited to 24 participants per class. And again, if you want to know more, head on over to wilmshurstuniversity.com and use that sign-up form for announcements. And it's just through MailChimp, so no big deal. It comes to me only. And I hope you guys are interested. It's going to be a lot of fun. Next up, I do also want to mention that website that I did launch, MasonicInstruction.com. Many of you have been using it to book speakers for your lodges. And I don't see these emails or anything like that. I am just doing this as a free service so that you can find great speakers for your lodge. I will tell you, I worked with Brother Alex Powers to add a search function. You can search the website for talks by category. Click the drop down, select a category, bam, the speakers will appear. You can enter each of their profiles and see talks that might interest you or your lodge. So check that out as well. And the last thing for this week is I want you all to please consider signing up to join the Southern California Research Lodge and get the magazine, The Fraternal Review. Why am I saying this? Well, not only is it an amazing magazine, it's done by the Southern California Research Lodge, but also the March issue that's coming out is going to be a whole issue that I guest edited on the Masonic Legacy Society. What is the Masonic Legacy Society? You know what? Better than anything else that I can do, I can just tell you, go to the website, MasonicLegacySociety2026.com. Why 2026? That is the 250th anniversary of this great experiment, United States of America. Head on over there to check out even more. That's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. It's been incredible. I hope you enjoyed the interview, the information, Wilmshurst University. Please go check it out. I want to thank the contributors, producers, fellows, and the legacy partners for funding this show for almost 10 whole years now. I also want to thank the brothers who reached out and said, hey, the Conference of Grand Masters was on this last weekend, and we saw a video by Wentz Kamu that was being presented right there on the Conference of Grand Masters. Thank you for finding that. I had no idea. Brother Jeremy Barnes reached out. He said, dude, check it out. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's really cool that they used that. So thank you very much for checking it out. Thanks to all the people who have found us through there and have begun to subscribe and check out to those videos. And really can't thank you all enough for allowing me to be able to bring this program to you week after week, month after month, year after year. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.